Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, as you all know, this podcast is all about getting dressed. And while clothing is certainly a huge part of that daily act, it is not the only one.
Getting dressed extends to any modification of the body, wearing perfume and makeup, and even tattooing. All of these are aspects of getting dressed, as is the subject that we are here to talk about all this week, the art, act, and profession of dressing one's hair. And this is a subject which is at the heart of today's guest, Dr. Elizabeth L. Block's new book, Beyond Vanity, The History and Power of Hairdressing. And it is an incredibly well-researched, captivating, and diverse history of women's hair and the cultural power that hairdressing held in 19th century America.
Yes, and far from a frivolous pursuit, Beyond Vanity really positions hairdressing as a subject for serious scholarly inquiry, with Liz successfully arguing for its central role as a significant cultural force that shaped not just women's lives, but the society within which they lived. And Liz takes us on a really fascinating journey from the intimacy of women's bedrooms to the bustling international hair trade market and makes an incredibly compelling argument as to why hair matters, something that, of course, still very much resonates with us today.
A brief introduction to Dr. Block. Liz is an art historian and senior editor at the Publications and Editorial Department at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And if her name sounds at all familiar, it's because she was also a past dressed guest. She joined us last year for a two-part discussion about the Gilded Age fashion influencers at the heart of her award-winning book, Dressing Up, The Women Who Influenced French Fashion. Liz, welcome back to Dressed.
Liz, welcome back to Dressed.
Thank you. This is so exciting. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, and thank you for this wonderful book. It's so incredibly fascinating, as our listeners are going to learn throughout this conversation today. And I would just love to know a little bit more about the inspiration behind writing it.
So my first passion topic and subject in graduate school was hair and hairstyling and representations of women's hair. So specifically, my area of focus is late 19th century American painting. So in the Metropolitan Museum, for example, that would be portraits of women, specifically by painters like John Singer Sargent, Winslow Homer, Mary Cassatt, Cecilia Beaux, and on and on. And what I found during the late stage of my studies was that I was much more interested and much more drawn to the representation of women's hairstyles and clothing than to the biographies or even like the painting techniques of the artists. So that all led to my focus on the material and visual culture of women's lives. I can give a couple of examples, if you'd like, of portraits that people might know.
Sure.
In the Met in the late 19th century galleries, there are portraits by John Singer Sargent that listeners may be familiar with. But there's one that really got this study on the road, and that was the painting of Mr. and Mrs. Phelps Stokes by John Singer Sargent. And it's a very long, tall, narrow oil on canvas painting. And it's of a husband and a wife. And the woman is Edith Minturn Stokes. And she's just this real beauty. She's in her early 30s and she's wearing a sporty outfit. And she's the epitome of the new woman, the youthful, independent woman. And her husband is standing behind her. Very important. But I was always drawn to the fact that she holds this straw hat, like a boater hat, in her right hand down by her side. And so her head is bare, meaning that we see her conservative updo hair. It's shorter than a later style of bouffant for the new woman that we'll talk about. But she's just the picture of confidence. And she takes up an enormous amount of space on the canvas. And so that's really where my focus lies.
Yeah, and actually that leads me directly into my next question. But first, I also just wanted to say that in terms of scholarly works, this book is really important because it is dedicated to studying the history and cultural significance of hair and hairdressing, which is a fairly new field, right?
Hair studies is new. Yeah. It is. And it's incredibly exciting, the work that's happening. There are a few of us who are digging deeply into hair scholarship, the representation of hair, the meaning of spending time on hair. And in general, I think that there's so much more work to be done. And in a way, it's like fashion studies maybe 30, 40 years ago.
Yes, exactly. And as many of our listeners will know, we know that fashion, the fashion body, is a really significant site of cultural meaning. But as this book argues and illuminates, so too is hair. So it's really fascinating and something we're going to dig into a lot more. But you mentioned something about Mrs. Stokes taking up a lot of space and that John Singer Sargent portrait. And your book actually focuses on the places and spaces in which women did their hair, got their hair done, where the hair industry operated. Why was this connection particularly significant to your story?
In the book, I argue that hair has been overlooked in historical studies in the late 19th century and mid-19th century due to its ephemerality. So what do I mean by that? Ephemeral means something that does not last forever. And hair is ephemeral. It's not like dresses. We don't have actual physical hairstyles in museums, for example, or to buy at auction like we would a couture dress by the House of Worth or one of his competitors. So my methodology for the book turned to how can we de-ephemeralize hair? That sounds a little lofty, but one of the ways that I came up with doing so was to start looking at the actual places where women engaged with hair, either with their own hair or providing services to other women or providing and making hair products. So those places include actual buildings, which are very rare. So I ended up looking at floor plans of where hair industry places were. So like hair salons in hotels, for example, were some of the ones that I was able to find floor plans for in more abundance would be photographs of the exteriors and interiors of hair accessory stores and of early versions of salons. So that approach is how I try to, and I hope succeed in grounding the ephemeral, so grounding hair.
And you did succeed, absolutely. And we'll talk more. We're going to really dig into that in a bit. As you testify to in the book, you say hairdressing was anything but frivolous. And that is something that has, of course, also been said many times about fashion, is that fashion is frivolous. You and I know hair like fashion is not frivolous. Our listeners know hair is not frivolous and the significance of hair is not frivolous. But apparently many people in the 19th century did not. And you actually trace this association between hairdressing and frivolity to a very specific moment in hair history. Can you tell us about what you discovered?
That would be the French Revolution. So in the old regime in France, you have these elaborate artificial wigs that were associated with aristocrats. This is specifically with aristocratic men who had the time and the money to commission really refined, huge hairstyles. So if you picture Louis XIV, Louis XV, those voluminous wigs, and then, of course, Marie Antoinette. But after the French Revolution, these big wigs, where the term comes from, for men and women, were shunned as being just extravagant and extremely impractical, especially in the American colonies, where Republican ideals just did not jive with massive wigs that took hours to style and then reduced movement for men and women. So that impracticality became just lampooned, and you get lots of caricatures of late 18th century hairstyles. These would be familiar to us from Bridgerton.
Queen Charlotte.
Queen Charlotte. Very yes. Exaggerated. Super fun to look at and to watch, though. But massive hairstyles and wigs with little miniature boats in them and things like that. And those are images that have had a lasting impression on us and also in the 19th century. It's probably because the caricatures were so successful, and many of them are in museum collections, and I do reproduce one or two of them in the book.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually did a reel on Queen Charlotte's wigs because people kept talking about how they weren't historically accurate. Actually, they are incredibly historically accurate in terms of this exaggerated, over-the-top hairstyles, or les poufs, as they were called, the poof hairstyle in Marie Antoinette's day and age. But yeah, they were incredibly wonderful from a fashion history perspective. But yes, lampooned repeatedly. And then thus, as you just spoke to, this association between the art of hairdressing and extravagance and frivolity. So one of the central themes of your book is the cultural work of hair. In other words, you're investigating the many significant ways in which hair drives and participates in culture and society during this period, beyond aesthetics, right? And it's actually something that can be interpreted as a visual language. And our listeners are well familiar with the visual language of clothing. But what did hair communicate at this time without having to say a word, both personally and within a broader societal and cultural context?
Hair is a common material with the uncommon ability, I think, to express individuality, and in the late 19th century, especially, to fuel an industry that launched the careers of many women, so a path to empowerment. But the fact that hair, the presentation of hair, can be extremely political is a sign to me that it needs to be deeply studied. And as we mentioned, hair studies is in its infancy. It's new. Scholars and activists are doing some really terrific work on 20th and 21st century hair, especially with Black women's hair. And I'm thinking specifically of the Crown Act, which is legislation that's going through Congress in the United States, where a coalition has come together to advocate for all human beings to be able to wear their hair however they want in the workplace and in schools, for example. But there's still, of course, discrimination and cases that are happening and reaching the media. So the power of hair is being recognized, but the power of hair in the 19th century certainly has not received its due treatment yet or until now. And there's so much to work with. So a common material, but with incredibly uncommon political power.
Yeah. And something that isn't certainly not a part of our society necessarily today is things like hat and hair etiquette of this era. And the fact that the way that you wore your hair, the way you presented yourself in society, and of course, your hair is a very important part of that, as you write about the book, is directly linked to things like your morals and your respectability. Can you talk a little bit about the visual language of hair in terms of wearing your hair down versus up and what that communicated at that time?
Yes. So respectability politics is in play in this time. So as a young girl, you could wear your hair down, say, until about the age of 12, 13. And then, especially if you were in the upper classes, you would wear your hair down until your coming out parties. If there are any listeners who watch the Gilded Age show on Max, the character of Gladys, she has her hair down until her coming out party. And then her hair is swept up into a very contained updo that would be expected of any woman in society, certainly of a woman who was of marriageable age. So in order to convey your respectability, that you had the proper morals and that you were an upstanding citizen, as a woman, you would wear your hair up, pinned up, and you would be following styles that you see in periodicals like Cody's Ladies Book or Frank Leslie's or Peterson's, and you would try to wear your hair in the latest styles, but they were all pinned close to the head.
Yes, absolutely. And something I thought was also really interesting that you write about is how long hair, when worn down by women, communicated something very specific, right? It was erotic in nature. And then you also write about the stigma that things like hair dyes and color had within society, which I think is so fascinating. And then something else I thought was really important about your book is you talk about how hair is a site of anxiety for society, because hair is a site of societal anxiety about the blurring of class lines. And you write about the fear of class jumping, right? So, you know, working class women, if they're modeling these really fashionable middle and upper class hairstyles, then there's somehow this blurring of class lines, which I just think is so fascinating.
Oh, yes. The blurring of class lines is so interesting. And of course, the anxiety mostly comes from men. The men were concerned that if middle class women were wearing their hair in, say, later in the century, say, in the bouffant style or in a pompadour style that was fashionable, that upper class women were wearing, that they would not be able to distinguish between a middle class, say, shop girl and an upper class woman. So most of that consternation comes from the men. And it's very similar to the wearing of shirt waists that were democratized later in the century, a type of shirt that was mass manufactured and that middle class women and some lower class women could buy in the United States at a reasonable price. And so you had this concern, this anxiety, as you say, that women could not be distinguished by class due to their hairstyles and in conjunction with their clothing.
Something I also really appreciated about your book is that you expand your study beyond white middle class women. Can you just speak a little bit about why that was important to your work and what you discovered?
It was very important to me that this book address the topic of hair of all classes and ethnicities of women in the United States in this period that I look at, which is post-Civil War to about 1900. My first book, Dressing Up, The Women Who Influenced French Fashion, was focused on women of the, not even the upper 1% of society, but like the point 0.01% of society. And those women were majority white. But when you're talking about hair, which is so universal, like I said, it's a common material with uncommon abilities, you need to look at all classes of women and all ethnicities. So I look at women of the lower classes, middle classes, upper classes, white women, black women, mixed race women. I look at the stereotypes, the racism that runs rampant through the vocabulary of hair at the time, and the racism that runs through the products that were put out at the time. But also from the angle of hair being a path to empowerment for black women and mixed race women, and how they were wearing their hair and how they were putting out products that spoke to and addressed the issues of hair that resonated with them, hair like their own. And we will, I think, get into some of the entrepreneurs who address these issues.
Yes, absolutely. More on that in a minute. But first, another consistent theme throughout the book is the profession of hairdressing. And as you just spoke to, the opportunities it afforded women. Can you give a brief history of the profession and how it developed into the latter half of the 19th century, specifically in the United States, which is the focus of your book?
The field of hairdressing professionalized in Europe really early on, so in the early 17th century. And as with the world of fashion, the United States is always coming later and emulating Europe. In the United States, the process of hairdressing coming to its professional fruition happened in the last quarter of the 19th century. And how does a trade become professionalized? It does that by putting out a trade magazine, a magazine for practitioners in the world of hair. And that was called The American Hairdresser. And that began publishing out of Brooklyn, New York in 1877. And then another way that a trade becomes professionalized is by starting an academy, educating the new generation of professionals. And in the US, a hairdressing academy was founded in Chicago in 1890. The academy and official organizations were open only to men. But when I spent time with the trade magazines, there are a few issues of hairdressing trade magazines in the library at FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. I found that even though women were not on the boards of these organizations and academies, and they weren't on the publishing board of the newspapers, women were certainly advertising their services. And they were writing articles for these newspapers on a regular basis. And they're really incredible. So as usual, women are circulating throughout this industry very strongly.
Yeah, and it really becomes like a huge business in the latter half of the 19th century. And you talk about how powerful women as consumers were in shaping that industry and shaping the trade. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Cass, did you know that learning a new language is only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, dress listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up. Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dress listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st.
There's so many wonderful illustrations and images throughout the book, and I loved this L. Shaw ad from the 1890s because, it, again, talking about grounding the hair in a time and place and just exemplifying how hair was taking up space and the hair industry was taking up space at this time. This ad talks about how this building is located at 54 West and 14th Street in New York City, and it's advertised as the largest hair emporium and toilette bazaar in the world. This entire building, four-story and basement, devoted exclusively to the creation of the latest fashions in hair and to the production of pure and effective toilette requirements for fashionable ladies.
A hair emporium. Let's reinvent that phrase and put the sign on our hair stores all over. L. Shaw was just a huge manufacturer and commercial space. And the fact, as you say, that this building took up several floors and there were products being sold, there was hair being done. It was a company that was owned by a husband-wife team and then taken over by the wife after the husband passed away, which is pretty common in this world of hair. Yes, these places took up space. They were marking the landscape. These were architectural buildings, like structures that had heavy equipment in them. I found through studying some of the imagery, like the L. Shaw catalog and many trade cards that exist out there, and through a newspaper and magazine advertisements, that these hair places like the Emporium, they were filled with permanence. And what I mean by that is, so the hair is ephemeral, right? But the actual like equipment and gear that were in these hair places and stores were heavy. So they had a permanence to them, like barbershop chairs. These chairs were adjustable, and although they were used and they were marketed to barbershops, women who owned hair places also purchased these chairs from these manufacturing catalogs. And the chairs look so comfortable. They're like padded and upholstered. And if you were the owner of a salon, you could choose what fabrics you wanted, what velvets you wanted on your chair, and you could pick the finishes like nickel or copper. And the chairs were adjustable, so you could have your clients recline in them, but they were extremely heavy. I mean, these were, you know, made of base metals. And I just love the sense of investing in the equipment and in the accoutrements that you had in these hair places, not just in the building, but in the equipment that was inside of them.
The material culture of hair from this period is so fascinating. And I just to quote from your book, shampoo stands were only one category within the vast offerings from trade catalogs. There were work stands, mirror dressing cases, cabinets, looking glasses, shampoo sprinklers, and chairs galore. Patented reclining chairs with headrests, footrests, caned seats, cushioned seats, upholstered seats, and all matter of ornamentation constituted a competitive category.
Yes, you could choose to your heart's content. There is a catalog that I love that has all types of sinks that people could choose from, that salon owners could choose from. And it's like triple wide sink, quadruple wide sink. And it's like, you know, how did you actually position your clients around those? They're just really, really, they're really fun to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. So now that you've taken us inside the hair emporium, I would love if you could actually take us through a customer's typical experience at a hairdressing parlor at this time. So what types of services might they have gotten and what products would have been used?
There was much more hair dressing and hair cleansing going on in these proto salons, we can call them, than actual cutting. So I like to point that out because the ideal for white women's beauty at the time was to have long, luxurious hair that was wavy or curly and it glistened in the sunlight. And the length was important because you wanted to have long strands of hair so that you could twist them up and braid them up into the styles of the day that you would pick up from the magazines and from trade cards and from celebrity cards that were circulating. So long hair was the ideal. And so there wasn't very much cutting going on. You might snip your split ends at home. You might well go to even a male barber to get your split ends taken care of. But when you are at the salon or the hair rooms, you would be getting your hair washed. You would be getting your hair styled. And you might have a shampoo job done, and the salon owner and the hairdresser might choose to use what was a very popular shampoo mixture at the time. There's just so many of these in the recipe books, I can't even tell you, but egg yolk shampoo. Okay, right. So a typical egg yolk shampoo mixture would be 3 egg yolks, a tablespoon or 2 of castor oil or olive oil, and then water. And then you would mix that up into a lather. I guess it was the yolks would get into a little bit of a lather. I don't know. It's a little hard to make out. So one of us will have to try to replicate this shampoo at some point. But your hairdresser would put the shampoo into your hair and lather it as much as possible, and then rinse the egg yolk shampoo out of your hair, which must have taken a very long time. And then you would have your hair either dried by, if it was after 1890, you could have a hair dryer. This would be really au courant to have a massive hair dryer rolled over to your workstation to dry your client's hair, or you would go home and air dry your hair. It was really thought to be beneficial and hygienic to air dry your hair, which would have taken a very long time, talking about the time that was devoted to hair practices. If you had these long strands of hair that went down to past your shoulders or even to your waist, it could take hours on ends for your hair to dry. And then also when you were in the salon, you would probably be buying some products there. So people who own salons would package up their own products, and you see these advertisements in the photographs, which are rare to see, but in the precious few that exist, you can see advertisements for hair products like the 7 Sutherland Sisters. They had many hair restorers and tonics. There's even a restorer called the Mary Washington Restorer. People got really clever with their advertising, but these products might be lined up on the shelves. And so you might pop into a salon and buy a product and then head home with it and wash your hair at home.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about, there is a notable difference in hygiene practices in the 19th century versus today. Can you talk a little bit about what those were and what the standard for taking care of and washing your hair was at this time in general?
I think there are some exaggerations about hygiene at the time, specifically what I found with cleansing of hair. So, I mean, this is what I can conclude. Women would probably wash their hair once every 2 weeks. I think that seems to be about the average. Some etiquette books and advice columns will recommend not washing it more than once every 3 weeks or once every 4 weeks. And that's where we get this image of this must have been so icky. But I think once every 2 weeks, it seems to be what people were doing. And they weren't shampooing their hair with water that often. Once every 2 weeks is not that often, but they may very well have been cleansing their hair with a dry powder, so a dry shampoo, and putting it into their scalp and putting it into their hair, and then combing the powder through, and the powder would pick up dirt and oil, and then you just comb. There's just so much combing that's happening, and that would clean the hair and keep the scalp clean. There was a lot of focus on scalp health.
And I was going to say, one of the things you could get in these hair emporiums, you could get things like scalp massage, as well as manicuring, hairdressing, wigs. And then something I found really fascinating about this period that I was not expecting at all is that you talk about that women were actually dyeing their hair, which is fascinating to me because there was such a stigma around makeup and cosmetics and artificiality of how someone looked. But can you talk a little bit about how women were dyeing their hair?
Hair dyeing was happening at a pretty fast clip. There are tons of advertisements for natural hair dyes. So one of the ways that manufacturers tried to get around the stigma of dyeing your hair, which was thought to be non-respectable, again, back to the respectability politics of the time, one of the ways that manufacturers would present products was to say that they were all natural. So you weren't doing something that was unnatural or immoral, but you were putting a natural color into your hair to enhance it. Whether or not those products were actually natural is up for question. I've started looking at some of the ingredients that went into the dyes, and some of the ingredients really are harsh. There's even petroleum, like flammable ingredients that are going into some of the hair dyes. But hair dyeing was certainly happening. The gossip columnists love to comment on it and say that Alva Vanderbilt's hair is looking a lot darker today than it was a couple of weeks ago. So the youth culture, the wanting to look youthful, was in play at the time, I guess, as it is today. But as with any period in history, there are many contradictions that are happening. So in the book, I do focus on some of the beautiful images of silver hair, gray hair, as it was shown in some beautiful miniature portraits of the period of the late 19th century. There are many miniature portraits in the collection of the New York Historical Society, and they show one in particular of an older woman who has her beautiful silver hair looped up into kind of a new woman bouffant. And she's an older woman, but the silver in her hair is really being celebrated by the painter.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
It's very cool.
Something that you've mentioned and spoken to a little bit, and something you write about in your book, is that, quote, the most skilled practitioners engaged only in the dressing of the hair, not its cleansing. And then, of course, as you mentioned, really not its cutting, because cutting didn't need to be an art form, right? Because you were never really seeing women's hair down at all. And then you also write about how columnist Frank G. Carpenter comments, quote, most ladies of fashion have their hair dressed by an artist for every evening reception, and some call for his services twice in one day. So really, the hairdresser was a really significant role in society at this time. And in your book, we get to meet some of these hairdressers. And Eliza Potter, for instance, life and memoir, was a revelation to me. I actually think I'm going to do an episode on her. I've been reading her memoir, which is really fascinating. But can you introduce our listeners to her and her significance to hair history?
Eliza Potter was from Cincinnati, Ohio. She was a Black hairdresser who worked with wealthy white women. So she worked on wealthy white women's hair at their homes. But intriguing about her remembrances, she wrote this incredible book called A Hairdresser's Experience in High Life. It's so early. It's published in 1859. It's just fascinating. But Eliza Potter worked with wealthy women, and she would travel with them to do their hair at their vacation homes or at their vacation resorts. And some of those include Newport, Rhode Island, and Saratoga, New York, which Potter focuses on. And she's just this incredible voice. She gives us the inside view on what a hairdresser's life was like. And she comments and she gossips.
Yes. It's basically one big gossip book, which is what's fascinating.
Yeah, which makes it so fun, so incredibly fun to read. But she comments on upper class white women's behavior and, you know, what they were after. And there is this preface to her book. It's called The Author's Appeal. And if you'll allow me, I'll just read a few words because it really sets the scene for her writings. And she says that the physician writes his diary, and doubtless his means of discovering the hidden mysteries of life are great. The clergyman, whose calling inspires the deepest confidence and to whose ear the tales of sorrow are unreservedly breathed, sends forth his diary to an eager world. But the hairdresser will yield rivalship to none in this regard. If domestic bitterness and joy and all the heart emotions that exist cannot be discovered by her, she defies all the rest of the world to find them out. So how powerful. She's aware of the power of her inner view that she gets of these women's lives in Newport, Saratoga, and in New York. And she's not afraid to write about them. Her hands are like in their hair. And she is, of course, having thoughts about how they conduct their lives.
Yeah. And I mean, something that's really important with that quote, too, is that she really validates and elevates the significance of the hairdresser. Like, she actually knows her worth and she's defending her worth, which is really fascinating because as a Black woman in the pre-Civil War era, she's really navigating a lot of racialized climates, right? Especially what's really fascinating about her book, and if I end up doing an episode with her, is that she goes to the South. She works in the South. And so it's a really, really interesting and important, I think, perspective that you just really aren't getting anywhere else, as far as I know, especially the fact that she is a hairdresser. And it gives her access to all these intimate places of people's lives, which is just so fascinating. So more on her coming soon, dress listeners.
And I just want to give a call out that there's a 2009 edition of her book with a terrific introduction by Zomara Santamarina, and that is certainly worth seeing, that edition.
Yeah, and in my episode, I'll definitely be referencing that too, because she puts her into context a lot, which is really important because her perspectives and her opinions and beliefs on things are not necessarily what you think they will be. More on her coming soon, dress listeners.
Liz, thank you for this fascinating glimpse into 19th century hair care and the hairdressing practices and industry at this time. I mean, I, for one, find this so fascinating, especially when I run across in vintage magazines all the ads for all the fake hair pieces that women were adding into their hair at that time.
Oh, yeah, me too. And especially in terms of, as you just mentioned, all of these products that women used. And Liz and I talked about egg being a common ingredient in shampooing during this period. And I thought our listeners might be interested to know that you can still get egg shampoos to this very day. You still have products advertising the nourishing and shine promoting qualities of eggs, as well as its ability to enhance softness. And this really sent me back because I actually recall doing an egg shampoo on myself as a teenager, not with a product. Ooh. I just remember using egg because I'm sure I read about it in like Cosmopolitan magazine or something.
Especially in the teen magazines, there were always like weird, quirky recipes about what you could use in your hair.
Yes. Like
mayonnaise? I've done mayonnaise.
Yes, for sure. I've done mayonnaise. Yes. So a veritable salad in our heads, not something that has been reserved to the past, apparently. So I would actually love to hear from our listeners if anyone else has done the same.
Yeah. Maybe dress listeners, you want to try out some of those 19th century hair routines yourself and get back to us on those. And there are definitely several historical costumers and influencers working in the fashion history sphere on YouTube who have already tried out some of these products for you. And we will provide a link to that if you would like to check out those videos.
Yes. And something you should also check out is, of course, Liz's book, Beyond Vanity, which was just published last week. And also be sure and check out Liz's Instagram at Elizabeth L. Block. And there is just so much more to say on the subject of the significance of 19th century hairdressing. We really just skimmed the surface. So make sure you turn into part two of our conversation with Liz on Friday, where we meet some of the incredible women navigating the profession of hairdressing at this time. And until then, may you consider the significance of hair in your day-to-day life next time you get dressed.
Remember, we love hearing from you, so if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is where you'll find posts and reels to accompany each week's episodes. If you're looking for content specific to this episode, it can be found at #dressed510 and #dressed511. Also, if you need some fall reading, you can find a link in our show notes that will take you to our dressed bookshelf at bookshop.org, where you will find both of Liz's books, Beyond Vanity and Dressing Up, along with over, at this point now, Cass, 150 of other fashion history titles.
Yes, and you can find a link to that website in our show notes, where you can also find a link to our website, dressedhistory.com, where you can check out our latest offerings from the dress universe. That includes our ongoing classes and tours, which of course you can sign up for April's Fashion History Fridays at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City for a 90-minute tour of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world all the way into the 20th century. Although April, you are about to, and I know this, head with me to Paris.
Yes. And so that means that my Met tours for October and most of November 2024 are going to be on pause in New York City. But I do have some things up my sleeve if you happen to find yourself in Paris at that time. So head over to dressedhistory.com maybe in a couple weeks or so to learn more about Paris offerings.
And do you love dress, but do you want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to our ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month and enjoy our 8 new episodes a month ad-free. Well, that does it for us today, dress listeners. Thank you as always for tuning in, and more dress coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media.
need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.